This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. 10 to 14 years. That's how long you and I have to do something about our changing climate. Now, it's hard not to sound melodramatic reading the latest findings from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. To limit global warming, we will need, in the report's words, quote, rapid, far-reaching, and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society, unquote. The estimated cost? $54 trillion. There's no precedent for pulling off something like this. And the report says we are rapidly approaching a point of no return. But if we can make changes now, we can limit the warming of our planet. Is there the political will for different countries and industries to come together? Or should we just start taking lots of pictures of coral reefs now so we can tell our kids all about them when they're gone? Joining us to discuss it is Coral Davenport, the energy and environment reporter for The New York Times. Coral, welcome back to the program.
Hi, great to be with you.
And in Tucson, Arizona, one of the authors of the IPCC report, Diana Liverman, is a professor of geography and development at the University of Arizona. Professor Liverman, welcome.
Great to be with you.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts about this report and about the prospects for fighting climate change effectively. Email us 1A@WAMU.org, tweet us at 1A, or comment on our Facebook page. Let's begin, Professor Liverman, if we could, with a comment from the chair of the IPCC, the group behind this report, Hoi-Sun Lee. Here's part of what Chair Lee said at the conference where the report was released.
Climate change is occurring already and affecting people, ecosystems, and livelihood all around the world. Every degree of warming matters, and there's tremendous benefit in limiting it to 1.5 degrees Celsius in terms of eradicating poverty as well as achieving sustainable development.
Professor, maybe a good place to start would be to put the power of a degree into context. We'll be talking a lot about 1.5 degrees Celsius and 2 degrees Celsius and 2.7 degrees Celsius. How much of a difference does a degree or a half degree really make when it comes to ice caps melting or reefs disappearing or the impact on shorelines? Can you give us a sense of how powerful a degree is?
Well, every little bit of warming matters. People can see that in their gardens. If it's just even a little bit warmer, the rate of plants, the amount of water that you have to put on your garden will change. But in terms of the report, some of the really significant differences are at 2 degrees Celsius of warming, you could lose all of the coral reefs. Whereas if you can just keep it half a degree lower, we could probably save 70% of them, because many of these ecosystems are quite sensitive to even small changes in temperature. And you see the same sort of differences, for example, in losses of global crop production at 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. And the report also shows that we've already had 1 degree of warming, and we can see that effect in both weather events and forest fires and the frequency of heat waves. So the 1 degree we've already experienced is already having impacts on society and ecosystems.
Coral Davenport, tell us about the report itself. Were there one or two big takeaways that are perhaps different from what we already know about climate change?
I would say there were two explicit takeaways within the report and one implicit takeaway that was suggested by the report but very clearly expressed by its authors. The first is, as Professor Liverman talked about, the assignment of the report. The report was commissioned of these scientists by world leaders in the 2015 Paris Accord, which was the accord passed by just about every country in the world designed to limit global warming. The Paris Accord, the Paris Agreement, says that the goal of you know, governments working together to limit climate change should be to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. At the time the Paris Accord was passed, 2015, only 3 years ago, that was really understood to be the tipping point at which economies and human life and sort of the global economy would be irreversibly severely damaged by global warming. That was the objective. Let's avoid two degrees. But at the time that the Paris Agreement was passed, leaders of small island nations and vulnerable African countries, so the, sort of the countries that are already feeling the impacts, already seeing the impacts, asked the scientists of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to do this study to look at, well, okay, you know, Paris says we want to avoid 2 degrees, but what does 1.5 degrees of warming look like? How bad is that? Because we didn't know. We didn't know just 3 years ago what 1.5 degrees really looked like. And the leaders of these small island nations that are already experiencing severe inundation, loss of coastal livelihood, loss of, you know, major losses already, we're saying, well, you know, what if the bad stuff is going to come sooner? So this report tells us that 1.5 degrees actually looks a lot more like 2 degrees than we thought. A lot of the severe impacts that we thought were going to hit at 2 degrees several decades out are actually going to hit a lot sooner, just at half a degree of warming earlier, and hit by 2040, hit in our lifetimes. Right. So the report tells us that, and it also tells us that in order to avert that, world economies need to put in place radical, drastic, fundamental, transformative policies to change the world's energy systems, agricultural systems, transportation systems, urban systems. And you mentioned in your introduction that we probably have about 12 or 14 years to put those in place. Mm-hmm. The report actually says no. Those need to be in place. Those need to be done. The assignment needs to be completed in about 12 or 14 years, which means we need to start in the next year or two. And so those are the two explicit takeaways from the report. And the implicit takeaway is that they're probably and the report also says it's technically possible to do this, and it lays out a number of sort of technical pathways. Here are sort of the steps that need to be taken. Mm-hmm. It shows that it can be done. And then something that was very clear in Korea, where I just got back talking to the scientists, is there's a real recognition that while it is technically possible to do what the report calls for, it is politically improbable, especially given the sort of where the world's largest economy, in particular, the direction that it is going in terms of climate policy.
Yeah, that political improbability is exactly what some of our listeners have been commenting on. Raisin tweeted, "Sadly, this is yet another example of something that should be a nonpartisan issue that has been polarized for short-term political gain. If a fix happens, it won't be coming from government anytime soon." Jean emailed, "I am terrified for future generations that we will not come together to save our fragile planet. Short-sighted greed seems to rule. Change will be difficult and disruptive to the status quo, but the alternative is so much worse." Professor Liverman, it had been mentioned in terms of the people who were behind this report. I wonder if you could speak more about the coalition of scientists who came together to put this together. Last night, the president commented on the report in front of the White House, and he said, and I'm quoting him now, quote, "It was given to me, and I want to look at who drew it, you know, which group drew it, because I can give you reports that are fabulous, and I can give you reports that aren't so good, but I will be looking at it," unquote. Who is behind this report, Professor Liverman? I assume it's a global coalition of scientists, right?
Yes, it's actually a United Nations process that was agreed upon by governments, and scientists get nominated from all over the world. And for this report, there were 90 or so of us, and we worked together for 18 months. And basically, we're not paid. We have our travel paid to go to meetings, but it's a voluntary activity. And you basically read all of the scientific literature that's been published since the last time the IPCC did a report. So that's about 5 years of publications. I think we read 6,000 references, and then we assess them. We look at, okay, is the literature on sea level rise all going in the same direction and saying the same thing? And then we assign a confidence interval, you know, high confidence, because there's a lot of agreement that this is going to happen. We have a series of meetings to discuss what we think. And then at the end, we write a report. It's reviewed, and we had 420,000 review comments that we had to respond to from scientists all over the world and from governments. And then right at the end, we write a summary, which was why we were in Korea, and we negotiate every single word of that summary with governments to make sure that they understand what we're saying and that we're saying it clearly. So it's a very comprehensive process. It's very global. The scientists on this report were from 40 countries, and it's really hard work.
I imagine so. Before we have to pause, let me wonder if I can get to one more comment, Coral. Chris tweeted, "Don't pretend that individual actions can prevent catastrophic climate change. A handful of companies produce a staggering majority of the greenhouse gases and pollution leading to the slow destruction of the globe." Before we pause, how much is the onus put on industries rather than governments in this new report?
The government, this report was commissioned by world leaders for world leaders. So it really is focused on policy that governments should take. It absolutely acknowledges that there's a significant role, a major role for industry, but that role is probably likely to come responding to government action, to government policy.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment with Coral Davenport from the New York Times and Professor Diana Liverman, who is one of the authors of this report, Professor of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. We welcome more of your questions and comments as well. What concerns you the most about climate change, and what are you doing to try to help make a difference? I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
World water make the tide rise high. Come inland and make your house go by. Fools done upset the old man river. Made him carry slave ships.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing climate change and how long we have left to stop our warming planet from going past a point of no return and what we can do about it. There is a lot we can do, but are we willing to do it? We're discussing it with University of Arizona Professor Diana Liverman, who helped contribute to this new report, and Coral Davenport, who covers energy and the environment for the New York Times. You've already had quite a bit to say. We got this message from Andy, who is an oyster farmer in Alabama. Here's what Andy left in our inbox.
When I moved here in 1980, there were marshes, oysters, shrimp, crabs, and dozens of piers. Now much of that is gone. I built my first pier in 2012. It was destroyed 2 weeks later by Hurricane Isaac. I rebuilt and lost it again to Nate in 2017, and then again to Gordon in 2018. Now I'm watching Michael approach.
Hey, Andy, thanks very much for writing in. Sorry to hear about what's been going on with your piers, and I know that Hurricane Michael is very worrisome. It is just about to hit the Florida panhandle, so I know that you're watching that very, very closely. I wonder, Professor Liverman, if you could speak to part of what Andy said. I've seen a lot of my friends online saying, see, climate change, and people say there's no climate change, and look at these hurricanes that we've been having. How much should the average person be pegging things like Hurricane Michael directly to what we're seeing from climate change? There's still a lot we don't know about the cycles of severe weather, but what would you say to people like Andy who are worried about this kind of thing?
Well, first of all, that was heartbreaking. I hope he does okay through Michael. But we can't say that the hurricanes are directly related to global warming. What we can say is that the chances of these hurricanes are increasing as a result of global warming, because warmer atmosphere has more energy, can hold more water. So the chances of these sorts of extreme events, whether it's hurricanes or extreme rainfall or heat waves, are increasing with every little bit of warming.
Let me get to a few more of your comments. Sarah emailed, "I feel overwhelmed by the talk about climate change and don't feel like there is a unified voice out there letting families know what concrete steps they can take to make a difference. For our family, this has led to ever-present feelings of helplessness, anxiety, and guilt about the choices we make every day." Sarah, we will be talking about some concrete options in just a moment, but let me get to a few more thoughts that have come in thus far. Joel emailed, "You should stop framing this as what will politicians do. Politicians reflect the people that voted for them. Half the voters in the U.S. read Donald Trump's tweet that global warming was a Chinese hoax and voted for him anyway. That just goes to show how unimportant the issue is to the people in this country." Coral Davenport, I wonder if you could respond to Joel's email. I mean, the president has committed to taking the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. He kind of questioned the provenance of the agreement by saying, well, who wrote it up? Let me see who wrote it, and then I'll believe it. Does Joel have a point?
Well, in terms of policies being policies that address climate change, the U.S. really is in a distinctive place right now. I think around the rest of the world, we do see an expression of will by leaders to enact policies to limit greenhouse gas emissions. I think that there's a lot of questions on how strong those policies actually are. You know, the analysis shows that they're not strong enough to limit warming even to that initial 2 degrees. But in the U.S., what we see is President Trump not only, you know, essentially questioning the basic established science of climate change, but also moving to undo existing climate policies. President Trump has already moved forward with policies to undo regulations on greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, undo or weaken regulations on greenhouse gas emissions from cars. And he has said that it is his objective to promote the use of coal. Burning coal is one of the leading contributors to greenhouse gas emissions. President Trump wants to promote the use of coal in the U.S. and abroad. One of the findings of this report is that in order to limit climate change to the sort of least destructive level of warming, the use of coal will have to basically go down to zero by 2050.
So we no see more the US, coal, basically.
No more, just about no more coal. And it is, you know, that is an extremely disruptive policy recommendation. There's no question that there are industries and people who will be harmed, who will have their livelihoods disrupted by policies that go in that direction.
Well, let me jump in there for just one second. I'm sorry to cut you short, Coral, but I wonder in terms of the politics behind this, and I hear you on I totally hear you on how disruptive this is. It's like coal is so interwoven in the network of America's energy grids, it's kind of hard to just yank it all out. I wonder, though, in terms of the voices on the world stage, who we know that there are voices who are saying, well, coal would be really hard to pull out. Do you get the sense that there's anyone on the world stage saying, tough, our planet is our only home. You like coal? Tough. We got to get rid of it. Deal with it.
California.
California. Okay, so Jerry Brown, the governor of California, for sure.
Yeah, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, has sought to kind of step in, and he's trying to carve out a place for himself as a leader on climate change. It's not difficult for France to take that position because France doesn't really use coal. So we absolutely see world leaders saying, you know, this is what needs to happen. In China, it's very interesting because China is the world's largest greenhouse gas polluter and is a massive user of coal. At the same time, we are also the Chinese government has moved forward with actually enacting prices on carbon. They're enacting a cap and trade system that would force carbon polluters, coal polluters, to essentially pay a tax or a fee in order to pollute, which is designed to drive the market away from greenhouse gases, an idea that was invented in the United States but is considered sort of politically toxic here. In China, they can implement it by fiat. They don't have to deal with a Congress voting against it, as right. happened in the United States.
And I do want to talk more about that idea of carbon taxes as we continue in just a moment. But let me get to a few more comments. Brian emailed, "We have no leaders anymore with the skills or courage to do what's right, regardless of the political cost. We will keep polluting as long as the price of fossil fuels is low." Would be interested to hear from some of you listening who you trust, who you think some of the leaders are politically in this country, around the world, who you believe are sincere in their push to do something significant about climate change. Is there anybody that you think is for real in saying that we're going to make this happen? Or maybe if you are active with a politician or a government leader or a government agency that's doing something tangible that you feel people should know more about, we'd love to hear from you. What gives you hope that climate change is something that is actively being worked on where you are. Email us, 1a@wamu.org. By the way, we've been talking in terms of degrees Celsius. Yes, I know where we are. If you need a little conversion, 1.5 degrees Celsius, we mentioned 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees. For those of you who don't have a conversion calculator in your head, 1.5 degrees Celsius is about 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, and 2 degrees Celsius is about 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit, about 3.6 degrees. Anyway, Tom posted on our Facebook page, when the quote-unquote global warming scare first appeared long ago, it was made a political position by the Democratic Party. That immediately convinced me that the man-made weather change is nothing but a political hoax to fool the stupid. Professor Liverman, what would you say to Tom?
Well, I grew up in a country, Britain, where it's not political. And so for the first part of my life, I lived in a country where politicians and the public trusted scientists and accepted that global warming was happening. So when I moved to the US, yes, it was a little surprising to find how partisan this basic scientific problem is. And we have to find some ways to get over that, I think. And that's one of the things the IPCC reports try to do. We don't try to tell people what to do. We try to put together all of the scientific information so that policymakers can make their own decision. I did want to add, in terms of other regions that are doing their part, the European Union has already committed to reducing their emissions by 40%. And Costa Rica has agreed to be carbon neutral. California's policies are in line with what we suggest in the report would lead to lower temperatures. So it's important not to think that the planet is going to go down just because the United States isn't doing as much as it could at the moment. There are plenty of other parts of the world that are acting to reduce their emissions. But as Coral said, if you add all of those up, it's still not enough. At the moment, the commitments under the Paris Agreement would still take us to 3.5 degrees or so of warming. And the one other thing I'd like to say is there's confusion about centigrade and Fahrenheit, of course, with the 1.5, 2.5. But the other thing to keep in mind is that's an average global warming. So when we talk about that, it always is warmer over land than sea. So you could add a degree or two to any of these projections if you live inland from the ocean.
Coral, do you hear the kinds of things that Tom posted on our Facebook page in other countries besides the U.S.? By the way, Tom, I'm not sure where in the country you are. I would love for you to reply to your comment on Facebook to know, get a better sense of where you are in the country and what it would take to make you believe that climate change is real. Science has left you behind in terms of your perspective on this, but I get that this is political, and I'm just kind of, I would like to know what the logjam is with you, Tom. So if you're still listening, would you reply to your comments on Facebook? I'm just kind of wondering where the gap is for you in terms of being able to believe it. But Coral, absent Tom's response, or hopefully he will respond, do we hear things like what Tom wrote in other parts of the world, or is this kind of a U.S. thing?
In most of the rest of the world, no. Absolutely, there remains a debate in most of the rest of the world still about how much it costs to cut carbon emissions. If you do what this report suggests and put some kind of price or tax on carbon emissions, not only does it mean basically wiping out the coal industry, it also will almost assuredly mean taxing gasoline and leading to higher gasoline prices. That's politically inflammatory just about anywhere. There is one exception. There's in the U.S. is where this is sort of a really sort of remarkable and surprising phenomena. But we have seen this kind of emerging as well in Australia, where the politics around climate change are very powerful and have actually been responsible, played a major role in some of the national elections in Australia. The first Australian prime minister to enact a price on carbon got voted out of office because of it. And there is kind of a rise of a similar sort of a Tea Party or Trump-like movement in Australia that has started to question the science of climate change, and it's not shocking to see that in Australia because Australia is a very heavily coal-dependent country. It's a country that has huge coal resources, coal mining, and exports coal.
Right.
So it's not surprising to kind of see that debate grow up there. But those are really the only two parts of the world where you see this.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Several of you gave us your suggestions for what you're doing to try to fight climate change on a more individual level. One member of the 1A Text Club wrote, I've switched 90% of my light bulbs to LED bulbs. I installed a high-efficiency furnace. I've replaced my older appliances, such as a washing machine, dryer, and refrigerator, with Energy Star models. I use thermo-insulated curtains. I recycle aggressively. Richard emailed, I've ordered my Tesla Model 3 a few months ago. My charging circuit has been installed and I'm ready for delivery. It cannot get here too soon. No more gas. I'm also seriously considering solar panels and a power wall to further reduce my carbon footprint. That's that thing that Tesla makes that can basically take solar energy and put it through your home. I looked online. Richard, a Tesla Model 3 starts at $49,000. I'm not sure I can swing that. But a Chevy Volt starts at $34,000. Ford Fusion Electric is $27,500. Okay, so slowly coming down, slowly getting closer to affordability. Another member of our text club messaged reducing my carbon footprint by eating less meat. Another member of the text club was a little bit more despondent than that and wrote, I've completely lost hope for the planet. So instead of fighting climate change, I've just decided not to have kids. So I don't ruin their lives. Professor Liverman, what do we know about what actually makes a difference individually in fighting climate change? I hear lots of people talk about going vegan and not eating meat anymore. One of our listeners asked about planting and growing more trees. What is actually effective in terms of what individuals can do?
Well, there's a lot that individuals can do. And in fact, there's a book come out recently, Drawdown, that lists them and what their global effectiveness is, if people are interested in looking at the whole list. But in the report, we look at the feasibility and the impact of different changes. And certainly more of a plant-based diet can play a role, although it's only about 10% of greenhouse gas emissions from the food system. But just as important of that is food waste, because if we're putting a third of our food into waste dumps, then it's rotting and producing methane, which is another greenhouse gas. Moving towards renewable-based electricity, whether it's in cars or homes, is, of course, going to play a big role. But the one thing that a couple of people mentioned that's really important is efficiency. Energy efficiency can go a long way towards helping us reduce our emissions. And we've already seen that, and it's something that has great potential. But even if individuals make all of those changes, one of the things that the report points out is that to stay under 1.5, we've got to do some other things. We've got to protect and expand forests. We may need to, we will need to develop technologies that can actually take greenhouse gases out of the air and store them or sequester them in storage. So we need some technology innovation as well if we're going to get to 1.5. And another important issue that we raise is we recognize that those changes may not happen fast enough. And so one of the things we discuss in the report is what we call overshoot, which is where we may have to go to a higher temperature before it comes back down. And I think some of the people reading our report think that that's a more likely scenario than staying under 1.5, is to go through a sort of a peak warming through this overshoot period as we adapt our economies and energy systems.
Jean posted on our Facebook page, just back from a trip through Europe, I was struck to see miles and miles of turbines in country after country, and I knew my country was so far behind. Melissa tweeted, China uses more than twice as much coal as the U.S. Hard to believe some carbon tax is going to make much of a difference considering their population. Good point, Melissa. I want to dig into that a little bit further. Let's talk about carbon taxes. When we continue our conversation with Professor Diana Liverman and Coral Davenport of the New York Times, we'll add another voice to the discussion and we'll get some more of your questions as well. Stay close.
Radiation underground and in the sky. Animals and birds who live nearby.
Back now to our conversation with Coral Davenport of the New York Times and University of Arizona professor Diana Liverman. We got a number of messages from you in terms of how you are trying to make an impact with the fight against climate change. Here is a little mashup of two of the messages we got. This is Amy from Chesapeake and Jeff in Michigan. Listen.
I'm going through a sort of guilt slash frustration slash feeling of powerlessness that I can't do enough to stop that the path of destruction that we're on.
My pessimism comes because I believe that what's happening to the world is happening at a corporate level. And until more companies get on board and care about the environment, it feels like we're kind of on an inevitable path, and 2040 will be here before we know it, and we will reap the consequences.
Thanks, Jeff and Amy, for sharing your thoughts with us. Speaking of the corporate path, there are some corporations who are taking a position in the fight against climate change, including with regards to the carbon tax. Melissa tweeted, China uses more than twice as much coal as the U.S. Hard to believe some carbon tax is going to make much of a difference considering their population. Let's talk more about carbon taxes with one more of our guests joining us from London. Ted Halstead is the chairman and CEO of the Climate Leadership Council. Ted, welcome to 1A.
Good to be with you, Joshua.
What is the Climate Leadership Council?
It is a group that is co-founded by the broadest climate coalition in U.S. history to back a national solution, and it is pushing for a carbon tax where all the money is rebated to the American people in the form of a dividend.
Who are some of the backers of the council? Where does the funding come from?
So the council does not accept corporate contributions, but our founding members include four of the oil majors, the largest car manufacturer in the United States, the largest utility, but also the largest solar company in the United States, a very broad coalition. It also includes two leading environmental groups and opinion leaders from across the political spectrum, ranging from Ben Bernanke to Janet Yellen to Larry Summers. And of course, our plan is named after former secretaries of state James Baker and George Shultz, the Baker-Shultz Carbon Dividends Plan. But Joshua, let me clarify. There is a separate spin-off organization that is a lobbying organization, and that now has corporate funding, including from Exxon.
Okay. And it is connected to your organization, or you said it's a spin-off, but is there still a connection in any way or completely separate?
It is a separate organization that is the advocacy arm of the Climate Leadership Council. So the council develops this groundbreaking plan where all sides win. And Americans for Carbon Dividends, which is co-chaired by former Republican Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and Senator Breaux, that group lobbies for this plan. And it now has money from oil, natural gas, solar, wind, and nuclear power interests.
Coral Davenport, let's take a step back before we get into the plan that the Climate Leadership Council is advocating more specifically. Define this term carbon tax for us. What exactly is a carbon tax?
Sure. So the idea of a carbon tax is each ton of carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere, you can put a price on how much economic harm it causes. An important note on that is the economist who came up with that idea, his name is William Nordhaus. He's a professor at Yale, was just awarded the Nobel Prize for this idea on Monday, the same day that the IPCC came out with this report, which heavily cites Professor Nordhaus's work. So he came up with the idea of every ton of carbon traps heat in the atmosphere, and you can put a price on how much each ton of carbon hurts the global economy. And there's a range for how much that costs. It can range from $50 a ton to $100 a ton. There's debate about how much actual harm it can cost. But once you sort of place that price on the carbon, then you can essentially create a tax a price on carbon or a tax on carbon that you would impose upon polluters of carbon dioxide.
I'm sorry, Carl. I just want to be really clear in terms of who the tax is paid on. I mean, if I am a car maker, do I pay the, when we're talking about pollution from automobiles, does the car maker pay a carbon tax for producing the vehicle that belches out carbon dioxide, or does the oil company pay the carbon tax for refining the gasoline
most
that turns
likely,
into it?
Most likely you pay it as a car driver.
Okay.
And you would, we don't have carbon taxes in the U.S., so in some ways this is sort of you know, an intellectual debate, although other countries are working, are sort of further along on this. But the idea is, if this would affect how you drive, it would probably be taxed based on how much carbon dioxide would be produced by burning gasoline.
Gotcha.
So it would most likely be added to the cost of the gasoline that you put in your car. So if you're going to put in an amount of gasoline in your car that would produce a certain amount of carbon dioxide when you burn it, that would raise – that tax would raise the price of your gasoline. And the idea is then you would be motivated to buy a car that uses less gasoline, essentially. That's how it would drive the market. So consumers would want to buy electric cars, would want to buy efficient cars, not out of some sort of moral sensibility, but because actually a price on carbon would make it cheaper mm-hmm. to use an electric car. It's a powerful market signal.
Ted Halstead, yesterday ExxonMobil committed money to lobbying Congress for a price on carbon. Give us a sense of what that plan involves and why it's getting support now.
So the Baker-Schultz carbon dividends plan is based on four pillars. The first is a robust carbon tax starting at $40 per ton, which would actually be the highest carbon tax of any leading emitting country. All of the money would go directly back to the American people in the form of a carbon dividend, which means that the vast majority of American families, including the most vulnerable, would win economically from this plan. And a third pillar is that we would trade a high price on carbon and a growing price on carbon for some of the carbon regulations, simply because a carbon tax is a more cost-effective way to solve climate change.
Well, I just want to make sure I understand. So the plan, if the plan went into effect, there would be a tax on the carbon that I emit with my car or my motorcycle or whatever, and then the revenues from that tax would come back to me as a taxpayer in the form of a dividend. Is that what you called it?
Yes. So a family of four would get approximately $2,000 per year in dividends. And here's how the system would work. The more you pollute, the more you pay. The less you pollute, the more you win. So 70% of American families would come out economically ahead. And that's what's so transformative about the dividend concept, which is that we can have the most effective climate lever, which is a carbon tax, in a manner that is popular, populist, and equitable for the American people.
How much of that money would be spent on environmental programs or planting forests or doing research on cleaner energy? Would all of it just come back to us as taxpayers?
100% would go back to the American people, and that is what makes the plan popular and politically viable, because on Capitol Hill, you'll never get the two sides to agree on how to spend the revenue. Republicans will say, well, let's spend it on deficit reduction or lowering the corporate income tax. Democrats will say, well, let's spend it on renewable energy innovation or low-income support. It opens a Pandora's box. By contrast, when you return all the money directly to the American people, it closes that box. And what polling shows is that it's overwhelmingly popular. Most interesting, there's 3-to-1 support among Republican voters and Trump supporters for this plan, 4-to-1 support among millennials, which, of course, are soon to be the largest voting cohort.
I hear you in terms of the political viability. I think it's interesting that your organization has put together something that can actually pass, or at least in your view can actually pass, and seems to show support on both sides. I wonder if you believe that it would actually, for lack of a better word, work. I mean, just because it may pass politically doesn't necessarily mean it's going to protect us from the worst effects of climate change, although it may make us feel really good that we're paying this tax. I mean, will this actually help save the planet?
Yes, it will, and all economists would agree. We just put out a report called Exceeding Paris, which shows that our plan, if implemented in 2021, would exceed the U.S. Paris commitment by 2025. By contrast, if you took all Trump policies now, they would get you to about 14% reduction by 2025. If you took all the Obama-era policies had they remained in place, that would get you to 18% reduction by 2025. Our Paris goal is 28%. Our plan would come in at 32% reduction by 2025. And interestingly, this links directly to the IPCC report, which pointed to a carbon price as the most effective vehicle and wants to raise ambition. This would be the highest carbon price out there.
Professor Liverman, what do you make of this plan?
Well, it's certainly consistent with the recommendations in the report. And the one thing I would add is that there are countries and places where this is working. So in British Columbia, I believe, has a carbon tax plan that's very similar to the one that's being proposed. I did also want to, China. Is putting in a carbon tax as well. And we keep sort of pointing to China. I do want to mention that China's greenhouse gases per person are half that of the US, and their population isn't growing at all. So sort of trying to shift the burden to China perhaps isn't the right thing to do. And I really think that this discussion of what we can do in the US is very optimistic and maybe counteracts the pessimism that we heard from some of your listeners.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Before I let Coral jump in, because I think, Coral, you were just trying to jump in, I'll come back to you in just one second. I just wanted to acknowledge before too much time passes, a lot of you have been commenting on one particular aspect of how you're trying to influence climate change in particular. We received a lot of comments like this one that we got from Aaron in Florida. Here's what Aaron left in the inbox.
While we're looking for solutions to climate change, the obvious elephant in the room is actually a cow. And the fact that most people are pointing to things like fossil fuels and other forms of pollutants, but not looking at the individual choices they can make on what they put on their dinner plate is a problem. And if we all were to go vegan overnight, that would be the single move that each of us individually can make that would have the most positive impact.
Aaron, thanks for calling in and sharing that with us. Professor Liverman, before I come back to Coral, I just want to fact check that one more time. I think you said that the food supply-based waste pollution is only 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions. So if we all went vegan overnight, it would not be the single biggest thing we can do. But food waste is a significant impact. Did I hear you right?
Yes. I mean, it depends. Again, scientists, we always like to have a bit of uncertainty. It depends how you add up all the emissions in the food system.
Gotcha.
And if you do that, you can get to about 20%, but that includes food waste, it includes food transportation, it includes emissions from, and of course, the emissions vary by animals. If you eat chicken, it's a lot less per pound of protein than beef is. And in the report, we're realistic. We don't try to assume that everybody is going to be vegan. There are parts of the world, for example, pastoral systems in Africa, where people are quite hungry and the livestock protein is, in fact, the fairest thing that they can eat as poor people. It's really if we can even get sort of plant-based diets in line with dietary recommendations in this country, we could be doing a lot. And the final thing I would say is if we plant enough forests, you can compensate for some of the emissions that are really hard to reduce, such as those from people who can't move fully to a plant-based diet or another big elephant in the room, people who want to fly to other parts of the world.
I know we're low on time, but Coral, you wanted to jump back in. Go ahead.
Just one more thing to clarify on the impact of a price or tax on carbon. You asked, well, is this something that, would make people feel good, but would it really work? Here's how the new IPCC report describes it, and I'm reading from it right now. It says, a price on carbon is central to prompt mitigation. The report is very clear. This is sort of the absolute central biggest thing that governments can do to lower carbon dioxide emissions. And to your listener who said, the biggest thing we can do is change our diets, I would say probably the biggest thing that people can do if they're interested in this is tell their lawmaker that you know, ask their lawmaker to vote for a carbon tax or vote for some kind of price on carbon. That would have a lot more impact than trying to persuade most people to go vegan.
Ted, I know we're low on time, but what do you think is going to pull the political trigger on something like this? The midterms are coming up. I don't think there are many people on the campaign trail right now who are talking about climate change, although I don't know, maybe after this report, perhaps more people are talking about it. But what do you think it's going to take for us as Americans to finally do what Coral described and tell our lawmakers, like, we do not want this country to turn into a scene from The Day After Tomorrow. You have to do something right now.
Two things. First of all, the most encouraging trend is that businesses are now leading the way in the push for a national price on carbon. The second thing we most need is a plan where all key stakeholders can win. And we believe that's a dividend plan, the Baker-Schultz carbon dividend plan. And to end on an optimistic note, we think that this is the best hope for a grand bipartisan bargain on Capitol Hill, and we think it can happen much sooner than many believe.
Before we go, Professor Liverman, what's the next step from here? The report's come out. What's next?
Well, we're going to share the report with as many governments and people as possible. But the other thing is there were gaps in what we could find. And so as scientists, we're going to double down and try and fill some of those research gaps so that we can answer questions even more clearly and confidently.
One last tweet from a listener that I think sums this up very nicely. The listener writes, "It's not the planet that is fragile. The planet will be here long after us. It is the ecosystem that supports life, ours included, that is fragile." Professor Diana Liverman from the University of Arizona School of Geography and Development and an author of the IPCC report. Thanks, Professor.
Thank you.
Coral Davidson, who covers energy and the environment for the New York Times. Thanks, Coral.
Sure. Great to be with you.
And Ted Halsted, Chairman and CEO of the Climate Leadership Council. Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Joshua.
This show was produced by Stephanie Collette. To learn more about her and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.
I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We paved paradise, put up a pie.